Greetings, everyone. Welcome to the Law Hour. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, as an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour is heard on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5 over North America, and we're heard worldwide on the Internet 7 days a week. For more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. It's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour brings you important information about law, news, and current events. Stay with us for tonight's report on circumcision, the medical evidence in support of it, right after this message. Well, many of the lessons that you hear on this program are just a small part of my two-week basic school on courtroom strategy and procedure. Now, this class includes lessons ranging from what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you receive your complaint, summons, or citations. And you'll learn how to make a chronology of the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence, just like the police do. And you'll learn how to conduct a hearing, present evidence, cross-examine witnesses, ask questions, make opening and closing statements, enter exhibits and evidence, write motions, briefs, affidavits, and asseverations. And I don't just cover what goes on in the courtroom. You'll also learn the preliminary procedures of arraignments, mail setting, what papers that need to be filed, how to put exculpatory evidence into the record, how to present your legal and lawful positions, and what issues are appealable, and how to preserve those appealable issues for appellate review. Now, there are 28 essential elements to master in courtroom strategy and procedure, and you'll learn them all here at the law school in this class. Now, for more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call me at 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for my free general law CD package while you're at it. Remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the Gordon Law School. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, best of all, it's free of charge. Courtroom strategy and procedure is also available in compact disc for home education. And if you're online, you can go to the website. It's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct. 417-273-4967. All right, here we go. Circumcision hailed as a way to curb AIDS. Now, these articles that I'm reading to you come from the Internet sources. This one's dated July 15th, 2002. The medical review, the literature that I've been reviewing, started in 1860. We carried it on up to 1994, then 2000. Now, here's the opposite. Remember, the medical literature since 1971 says that it has no medical value whatsoever. Now we're finding out, no, there's lots of reviews and lots of studies on the medical values of circumcision as it relates to disease. Anything, anytime that you keep clean, it's a health aid. And this is a health aid that we can identify. Studies have been made. There is evidence in the literature of the health benefits. Now, they've been telling us that there aren't any since 1971, but they lie a lot. That's what the bottom line is. Now, new evidence suggests that circumcision, this is an article entitled Circumcision Hailed as a Way to Curb AIDS, comes from the Sunday Times in Great Britain. And I suppose you could go to the Sunday Times. It's www.sunday-times.co.uk. New evidence suggests that circumcision of all male babies could help to halt the global AIDS epidemic. With 50 million living cases and more than 16 million deaths, the disease is now the worst human health disaster since the Black Death. Okay, AIDS now is the worst pandemic to occur since 1348. It hasn't run its course yet. It's still growing worldwide. Now, the thesis laid out in a scientific paper to be published soon seems likely to create huge controversy as it represents a complete change in accepted ideas about the transmission of AIDS. One of the paper's authors, Roger Short, he's a professor of obstetrics at Melbourne University and a respected scientist with long experience of AIDS-ravaged areas, has been told he cannot address the subject at a forthcoming international conference, so he can't bring up the subject of circumcision. Short and his co-author, Dr. Robert Szabo, spelled S-Z-A-B-O, are convinced that a high level of receptor sites to which invading organisms attach themselves on the inside of the foreskin make it responsible for the transmission. Now, Short and Szabo noted a sharp difference in the prevalence of HIV infection in the AIDS Belt countries in sub-Saharan Africa. In some areas, the infection rates are as high as 25%, in others as low as 1%. Now, the lower infection rates were clearly associated with the practice of male circumcision. The presence of an intact foreskin, says the Short-Szabo paper, has consistently been shown to be the single most significant factor associated with the much higher prevalence of HIV in countries of the AIDS Belt. The link is stronger than with the more familiar indicators such as promiscuity and other sexually transmitted diseases and multiple marriage. Even more startling evidence came from a recent study in Uganda reported in February. This showed that among a large group of discordant couples, where one is infected and one not, no circumcised males became infected over 30 months, even though their wives were HIV positive. And Short describes these results as staggeringly significant. All right, so here's a woman that's got AIDS. Husband is circumcised, comes home, has sexual relations with his wife, and he doesn't develop AIDS. Why? Now they take a look at other men that are getting AIDS from their wives. They note that down. And they say to themselves, gee, the rate is 1% in this area, and the rate over there is significantly higher. Why is that? What's causing this? Well, the only thing that they can see here is that some of these men are circumcised and some aren't. Now notice it's 25% rate in many areas and as low as 1% in others. Now even more startling evidence came from the study in Uganda. Outside Africa, there is the same pattern. Countries with low circumcision rates, such as Thailand, India, and Cambodia, have between 10 and 50 times the rates of infection compared with countries with high circumcision rates, such as the Philippines, Bangladesh, and Indonesia. Once they get ethical clearance in Australia, Short and Acebo intend to test their conclusions by applying live HIV virus to newly removed foreskins to check its rate of uptake. They could have definite results within weeks. If experimentally confirmed, the implications will be radical. Short and Zabel believe that about 80% of male HIV infections in the world happen through the foreskin. Now, Short is not advocating adult circumcision. That's a painful and potentially dangerous operation, but future generations could be saved if mass circumcision began now in infants. Short believes his findings should be spread globally as rapidly as possible. There has been insufficient focus on prevention, he said, and too much emphasis on the search for a vaccine or a cure. Despite the billions poured into research, there is still no sign of an AIDS vaccine. Now, the crisis in sub-Saharan Africa, where life expectancy rates at birth as a result of AIDS have dropped from 59 to 44, the disease is totally out of control. Now, the whole of my life's prejudice has been anti-circumcision, said Short. So this Dr. Short's been opposed to circumcision. I've written papers against it, and I don't believe the benefits outweighed the cost. If God had made us the way we were, why remove a sound organ? But I have been totally converted since my research here in Africa. And then we have circumcision cuts HIV risk. This is another article, 71502. Male circumcision significantly reduces the spread of HIV virus to men. According to research, in terms of infectious diseases, AIDS is the biggest killer in Africa, with HIV frequent in the sexually active populations of many countries. But the study carried out by European and African researchers found that uncircumcised men were at least three times more likely than circumcised men to contract the virus. And they looked at four cities from different parts of the continent, and they noticed a marked difference in the incidence of HIV. So what we have here is another set of researchers doing research in Africa coming to the same conclusion from independent facts. It's not just sexual behavior. This said researchers could not be explained away simply by differences in sexual behavior. However, in some of the cities, circumcision, in which the skin covering the tip of the penis is removed, was far more common, and these had far lower rates of HIV. Anne Bouvee, B-U-V-E, an epidemiologist at the Institute of Tropical Medicine in Antwerp, said, "We did find that circumcision confers certain protection against HIV, and that it seems circumcised men do not get HIV as easily as uncircumcised men. Although the reason for the extra protection has not been proved, the research team suspects that the skin on the glands of the circumcised penis is tougher than that of the foreskin." Now, I'm going to pause right here. I want to point something out. On the skin, it goes back and joins over the head of the penis, and there's a foreskin that goes out over the penis. And so what modern circumcision has been is that you go back behind the glands itself and cut it off behind the glands. The Bible talks about cutting off the foreskin, not the skin over the glands, but the skin that protrudes over the end of the glands. That's the skin that picks up the HIV. And you'll notice that you have these severe circumcisions where they have taken all of the skin off, clear back behind the glands. And this doctor here is pointing out that their research shows that it's just the foreskin. The practice of cutting off the foreskin and then taking your fingernails and taking off the balance of it back behind the glands, I don't know what kind of a pagan practice that is or where it came from, or who thought that kind of perversion up, but that's not what comes from the Bible. And if you'll take a look at religious practices, you'll find that whatever the Bible teaches, the religious people will take that and go way beyond that and do something totally different. And then they will point to the Bible and say, well, we're just doing what it says in the Bible. We're just doing circumcision. No, they're not. No, they've taken circumcision way beyond the scope of reason, logic, or common sense. From 1860 to at least 1940, there was no scientific basis behind any of the circumcision being done. Doctors were claiming that it's over the issue of masturbation. There's nothing in the Bible about masturbation. That's just nonsense. What we're dealing with here is that the skin, evidently that foreskin, which is about 1 inch long, and it's smaller, more restrictive than the skin that's over the top of the glands itself. That's the skin that is the proper subject of being cut off, not the skin that covers the glands itself. It's the skin that goes out over the end. Now, I want to emphasize that because it's very important. When I was circumcised, that's what they did with me. Now, I've seen some boys that have been circumcised all the way back, and there have been some problems where the doctors, not knowing what they're doing, and then not using a flint knife, not using a scalpel, have tried to use chemicals and all kinds of other things, and have actually taken the whole penis clear off. Or they have set up infections which required cutting it off. Now, that's pretty drastic. We didn't get that from the Bible. We didn't get that from the covenant with Abraham. We got that from religion. We got that from medicine. We got that from paganism. Now, here's some science going on here. Scientists taking a look at the AIDS epidemic today have put some statistical information together. They point out this doesn't prove that our theory is correct, but I'll just leave it up to you. You figure it out. Jews don't get the penile cancer. And we find that in Bangladesh, where the people are Muslims, their incidence of AIDS among circumcised men is very low. Go over to Thailand and India, it's very high. Why is it? Well, at least we should start looking into that foreskin. We should look into circumcision. And notice that he points out here, they're not advocating going out here and circumcising all of the males, all of the adults. It's the infant circumcision that seems to have the best promise for stopping the AIDS epidemic. All right, going on, they say it's therefore less likely to suffer small abrasions, which increases the chances of HIV being transmitted. The study focused on Benin's capital, Cotonou, and Cameroon's capital, Yaoundé. Well, Benin's capital, I don't know what that is, Cotonou, I guess is the pronunciation. These are two little countries on the west coast of Africa, where circumcision is a widespread cultural practice. Now, when we get through here taking a look at the medical uses of it, we'll take a look at where did this circumcision come from, because there are a lot of groups in the world that use circumcision that aren't in any way connected with the Jews at all. No way connected with Hebrews or Israelites, but somewhere along the line, they have picked up circumcision. Now, these towns were compared with Ndola in Zambia and Kisumu in Kenya, where it is not. Another researcher urged Kenyan health authorities to ask, and he said, both at national level and at ethnic leadership level, the issue of circumcision needs to be discussed and encouraged. So there's the second article. Let's take a look at a third article here. What is circumcision? See if I'm through now with the medical aspects of it. I think I am. Now let's take a look at the thing of circumcision. Just what is it? Let's take a look, first of all, at the Jews. This is an article about Jews written by Rabbi Moshe Shapiro. And these are the comments that come from a contemporary rabbi. This is published 5/18/2004, so it's within a couple of days of being... See, today is the 20th. And it's just 2 days old. We just pulled this off the web for this program, this series of programs. How a simple mitzvah makes a worldwide eternal impact on the entire Jewish people. Brit Milah, or circumcision, is performed on a Jewish male 8 days after he's born. The procedure is performed by a mohel, a person who has mastered the set of Jewish laws regarding circumcision and received extensive practical training. At a Brit Milah, the mohel removes the baby's foreskin and draws blood from the reproductive organ, after which the baby is given a Jewish name. Why a Brit Milah? Well, Brit Milah literally means covenant of circumcision. Abraham, Judaism's founding father, was the first person in history to have a Brit Milah. In fact, he circumcised himself. Abraham vowed that he would teach his descendants to serve God with perfect devotion, and in return, God promised to guarantee the survival of Abraham's progeny, the family of Hebrews that became the nation of Israel that have since been known as the Jews. Well, I notice here that this Jewish rabbi takes the position that the family of Hebrews are the people known as Jews today. I take exception to that. But as long as there would be human beings in the world, God assured Abraham there would always be Jews. Now, the covenant, or this covenant, or pact between God and Abraham was sealed through the act of circumcision. Today, by performing the act, circumcision, Jews perpetuate the covenant and make their children a part of the eternal promise. And this rabbi goes on to say that it has a deeper meaning than that. The fact that the Brit Milah is performed on the eighth day after a boy is born hints to this idea of eternal Jewish continuity. In the Torah, all reference to the numbers have great significance. For example, the number 6 represents the physical world, which has 4 directions, north, south, east, and west, plus up and down. The 6 days of creation, the 6 days of the work week, also allude to the physical world. 7 adds a spiritual element to the physical. The seventh day, Shabbat, adds spiritually to our lives, though it is still within the realm of the physical world. 8, on the other hand, transcends the physical altogether. For example, the 8-day miracle. They call this the 8-day miracle of Chanukah, is beyond nature, surpassing the physical constraints of natural laws and standards. 8 represents a higher dimension of reality. God's guarantee that Abraham's children would survive forever as a nation defies the laws of nature. History has proven time and again that even the most powerful nations on earth are bound eventually to vanish into extinction. For example, the Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans. And yet the Jews, a numerically insignificant people, are still here alive and well. So the rabbi goes on and he says the Brit Milah performed on the eighth day reminds us that Jewish survival is not a natural phenomenon but a supernatural one. Jewish survival defies the laws of nature. This explains why the mark of circumcision is made on the reproductive organ. It symbolizes the idea that the Jewish people's seed will never be destroyed. In addition, Brit Milah is done specifically on the site that is identified with our greatest physical desires, thus empowering us to rise above the demands of our bodies. Now, the objective of the ritual circumcision, translating Brit Milah as simply circumcision rather than covenant circumcision, erroneously implies that the removal of the foreskin is the most important element of the mitzvah. In truth, however, the circumcision must be coupled with the intention to forge a blood pact between God and the Jewish people. For this reason, a person who underwent a medical circumcision without intent to fulfill his command should undergo a subsequent procedure performed with specific intent to fulfill this mitzvah. This subsequent procedure is relatively painless, involving only the drawing of blood from the reproductive organ, but done in the name of Brit Milah. Personal commitment. The secret to Jewish continuity lies in the Brit Milah, or Mila, however you pronounce it, which strengthens one's personal commitment to God. Once this is achieved, the communal commitment will emerge on its own. In his covenant of circumcision, Abraham vowed to teach his descendants to serve God with perfect devotion. This is the essence of Brit Milah, and it represents the individual's personal commitment to God. One's communal identification with Judaism is indeed a positive thing, but the mitzvah of Brit Milah teaches us that unless there's also a personal commitment, it will not endure. May we all merit to bring our children into the covenant of Abraham and see their Jewish identity flourish and grow. All right, so there's the Jewish perspective on circumcision. Note here, they don't see it as medical. In fact, this rabbi goes a step further, and he says, if you're just doing this for a physical purpose, then you're missing out on the point of the covenant with Abraham. His contention is that you'd have to go through a separate commitment. It's kind of like marriage, you know. You're going to have to go through a separate commitment over here and repledge your commitment to God and practice His law, I would imagine. But there's a separate ceremony here. These people aren't doing this because they're concerned about AIDS or health or penile cancer. They're concerned about their covenant, their commitment to their religion, their commitment to God, or their God, however you want to word it. Now, there's also an origin of non-religious circumcision. So I did a little research on this so we could take a look at the origin of non-religious circumcision. Circumcision itself began as a religious ritual or puberty rite as long as 6,000 years ago. Little editorial comment here, I think we could probably bring this down to 4,000 years ago. I don't think that this author has the evidence, and after all, when we're talking about law, we should be talking about evidence. Now, not all evidence is necessarily conclusive, and not all evidence necessarily proves beyond a reasonable doubt. But evidence is for the purpose of bringing to your mind information that you might not have considered before, and it may or it may not change your opinion. After all, you be the judge. I'm not here to push the case one way or the other. I'm here to present facts, just like I would to a grand jury. I'm here to present facts, and you, once you've gotten the facts, you can come to a conclusion. Now, going on, they start off by saying it started as an ancient Egyptian custom, and there are wall carvings to prove it. It seems to have its origin in snake worship. The Egyptians believed that when the snake shed its skin and emerged shiny and new again, it was undergoing rebirth. They reasoned that if by shedding skin the snake could become apparently immortal, then humans should follow suit. They made the simple equation snake skin equals foreskin, and the operation began. From there it spread to many Semitic peoples, both Arabs and Jews, adopting it and converting it into an act of religious faith. As the centuries passed, it became popular in other regions of the world for moral, medical, and hygienic reasons. From the book Baby Watching by Desmond Morris. Well, I'm going to pause right here and make a couple of observations. Number one, the number 6,000 has no evidence to support it. And the Egyptians believed that when the snake shed its skin and it emerged shiny and new again, it was undergoing rebirth. That may be what they were believing, but there's no evidence in the statement to prove it. And I'm looking at some hieroglyphics here in a painting. And if this is circumcision, there's no evidence that the hieroglyphic represents a particular date in time. There's no date on the hieroglyphic. So to say that it's 6,000 years old and antedates Abraham is speculation. It assumes facts, not an evidence. It's not competent evidence. It's evidence, but it's not competent evidence. It does not prove what this author says that it proves. But I'm going to put it out there for your consideration. Oftentimes a judge will say, well, I want to hear this hearsay because I want to see if there's anything to it. Well, non-religious circumcision began in England in the late 1800s, and it became extremely popular in English-speaking countries between 1920 and 1950. England introduced the practice to the United States. At the time, it was believed that masturbation caused a host of different illnesses. Masturbation was considered extremely immoral, and many children, both male and female, have been circumcised through the years because parents discovered them in the act. To this day, who doesn't remember the threat associated with masturbation that you will go blind? All right, we've already covered that. Evidently, that was a religious view. And then the medical doctors picked up on the religious view and said, well, gee, if these people are superstitiously religious, let's go a step further and let's advocate it as a routine in pediatrics and see if we can't make some money off of it. You see, except for the purpose of obeying God and keeping his commandments, circumcision doesn't have any purpose. Now, we're beginning to see there are some medical benefits that come from it, but the purpose was not medical. Abraham did not circumcise because of some health or medical purpose. Now, it was known, even in the late 1800s, that the removal of the foreskin, the only movable part of the penis, would reduce sexual sensitivity and restrict movement of the penile shaft. A noted Jewish sage, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, in his Guide to the Perplexed, expressed the following, quote, people believe that circumcision is to remove a defect in man's formation. How can products of nature be deficient so as to require external completion? Externally, as the use of the foreskin, that organ is evident. This commandment has not been enjoined as a complement to a deficient physical creation, but as a means for perfecting man's moral shortcomings. Circumcision simply counteracts excessive lust, for there is no doubt that circumcision weakens the power of sexual excitement and sometimes lessens the natural enjoyment. It was believed that masturbation caused blindness, mental illness, alcoholism, epilepsy, and a host of other ills. It therefore made sense to some physicians, at least, that genital surgery would stop masturbation, prevent the onset of these illnesses. A remedy for masturbation, which is almost always successful in small boys, is circumcision. The operation should be performed by a surgeon without administering an anesthetic, as the pain attending the operation will have a salutary effect upon the mind, especially if it becomes be connected with the idea of punishment. John Harvey Kellogg, M.D., and it's entitled The Treatment for Self-Abuse and Its Effects, Plain Facts for Old and Young, Burlington, Iowa, F. Signer and Company, 1888. Now, when it was fully realized that masturbation did not cause illness and the foreskin became the blame for penile and cervical cancers, urinary tract infections, and sexually transmitted diseases. Now, all of the medical reasons for circumcision have been eliminated, at least by the experts. Circumcised men are not immune to suffering from these diseases, so the surgery offers no warranty. Well, God never said that it did. What we're observing, though, in the world or in the field of AIDS is that people that are circumcised aren't contracting it as easily. Now, it doesn't prove that circumcision prevents AIDS, but there's something to it, and we may not know exactly what it is, but it ought to be investigated. All right, let's take a look here. I've got to do a station break here because it's 30 minutes past, so. You are listening to The Law Hour, and I'm your host, George Gordon. Now, The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest sponsored by the Gordon Law School. All of these Law Hour programs are archived for your listening convenience on the internet at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, over the past century, we Americans who were once independent, capable, and able to manage our own financial, medical, and legal affairs have now been reduced to dependence, incompetence, incapacity. We've been now made wards of powerful commercial, financial, medical, and legal corporations, cartels, and bureaucratic institutions of our modern industrial society. And we've been taught to rely upon these paid professionals like bankers to manage our financial affairs and doctors to manage and treat our health problems and lawyers to direct our business and legal affairs instead of relying upon our own good common sense. Now, that's why I contend that it's time that we Americans who were once able to catch our own fish learn once again how to fish instead of being fed by these paid professionals. And regaining our power of attorney is the single most important step in regaining our capacity, our rights, our liberties, and our duties. Now, if you'd like to learn more about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you write for my free general law CD package? It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. Best of all, it's free of charge, and you can order yours by calling direct 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to the website, send me an email. That's georgegordon.org. Then click onto that email machine on the website and send me an email request. Remember, that's georgegordon.org or call direct 417-273-4967. All right, we're back on the track here. Now, here's a story on circumcision that deals with the history of circumcision. A couple of three important points in here, so let's take a look. The practice of male genital mutilation is far older than recorded history. Certainly, it is far older than the biblical account of Abraham in Genesis 17. It seems to have originated in Eastern Africa long before this time. Okay, well, that's good. That's good. But it seemed that is not proof that it did that, so I want to point that out. Many theories have been advanced to explain the origin of genital mutilation. One theory postulates that circumcision began as a way of purifying individuals and society by reducing sexuality and sexual pleasure. Human sexuality has or was seen as dirty or impure in some societies, hence cutting off the pleasure-producing parts was the obvious way to purify someone. But that runs exactly opposite to what I've always heard. In fact, in all of the religions, including Christianity, sex is worshipped. You know, the idea of putting eggs out and rabbits at Easter time, those are sex and sexual rites of religion. This doesn't seem, just doesn't fit in with what I've always seen, what I've always read, what I've always heard concerning religion. These guys are out here with temple prostitutes. They've got rabbits running around. They're laying eggs everywhere. They are worshiping sex. They are promoting sex and sexual activity, which, if anything, would be condemned in the scripture, but I'm not really sure that the purpose for circumcision is to slow these people down. Seems like to me that they'd want to be speeding up. Anyway, take it for what it's worth. It is now known that the male foreskin, or prepuce, I guess that's the way to pronounce that, foreskin, is the principal location of erogenous sensation in the human male. Removal of this prepuce substantially reduces erogenous sensation. Therefore, in the appropriate cultural context, circumcision is revealed as a sacrifice of sinful human enjoyment in this earthly life for the sake of holiness in the afterlife. Now, the Jews adopted circumcision as a religious ritual, and they preserved this prehistoric practice into modern times. The circumcision of Abraham removed only the very tip that extended beyond the gland's penis. Now, that's the evidence that I see in the scripture, that foreskin is not the whole skin, but just the tip or the end, about 1 inch. Now, the circumcision of Moses and his sons, it says, were not circumcised. And Exodus 4, verse 25 is what they're citing. Although Moses apparently prohibited circumcision during the 40 years in the wilderness, Joshua in Joshua 5, verse 5 reinstituted circumcision at Gilgal after the death of Moses, Joshua 5, verses 2 through 10. And it's interesting to note that after the Israelites were circumcised, they immediately became soldiers in Joshua's army for the conquest of Palestine, Joshua 6, verses 1 through 3. Well, I might make a couple of editorial comments here. In Exodus 4, verse 25, it does not say that Moses was not circumcised. It doesn't say. And apparently prohibited circumcision during the 40 years in the wilderness. It wasn't Moses that made the prohibition, it was God that did it. Moses was a secretary, Moses was not the boss. Now, Joshua did reinstitute circumcision at Gilgal. It wasn't Joshua again, it was God. He said, okay, we ain't moving any further until we're circumcised, boys and girls, let's get with it. And it's interesting to note that after the Israelites were circumcised, they immediately became soldiers in Joshua's army for the conquest of Palestine. That's true. In contrast to the Jews, the Greeks and the Romans placed a high value on the foreskin. The Romans passed several laws to protect the foreskin by prohibiting circumcision. Much later in the Hellenic period, about 140 AD, the circumcision procedures was modified to make it impossible for a Jew to appear to be a Greek. And a radical new procedure called pariah was introduced by the priests and rabbis. And in this procedure, the foreskin was stripped away from the glands with which it is fused in the infant. Now, in a painful procedure known today as a synoctomy, S-Y-N-E-C-H-O-T-O-M-Y, see if I pronounced that right, synoctomy, more foreskin was removed than before, and the injury was correspondingly greater. With the introduction of pariah, the glands could not easily be recovered, and so no Jewish male would easily be able to appear as a Greek. And it may have been at this time that the Pondus Judaeus, also known as the Judaeum Pondum, a bronze weight worn by Jews on the residual foreskin to stretch it back into a foreskin, gained great popularity among the Jewish males. And this lessened the ugly appearance of the bare exposed circumcised penis. This restorative procedure was known by the Greek word epispasm, E-P-I-S-P-A-S-M, epispasm, or rolling inward. The third stage of ritual circumcision, the mesiza, or metziza, was not introduced until the Talmudic period from 500 to 625. I've got C-E down here. I don't know what C-E means. I'm assuming that that's before Christ. See, I was raised in another era when we used A-D and B-C. So the Hellenic period must be 140 CE. I think it should be Common Era. Let me see if I'm right here. Common Era. I've got here the third stage of ritual circumcision was not introduced until the Talmudic period, 5 to 625 of the Common Era. I think that's AD. In Metziza, the Mohel, the ritual circumciser, sucks blood from the penis of the circumcised infant with his mouth. This procedure has been responsible for the death of many Jewish babies due to infection. In modern times, a glass tube is sometimes used instead. Yeah, I hope they get over that. That's very unscientific, and it's very dirty. The Reform movement within Judaism considered circumcision to be a cruel practice. And the Reform movement at Frankfurt declared in 1843 that circumcision was not necessary. The Christians took a strong stand against circumcision in the first century, and Christians rejected circumcision at the Council of Jerusalem. As we read in Acts 15, St. Paul the Apostle to the Gentiles taught parents that they should not circumcise their children, and also Paul warned Titus to beware of the circumcision group. I put a mark on that paragraph. We'll take that up when we look at the New Testament and circumcision. I think that the evidence will show that another conclusion is more logical. Now, the modern use of Hebrew circumcision as a medicalized practice dates from about 1865 in England and about 1870 in the United States. The procedure accepted for medical use essentially was the Jewish pariah. Moscusi reports that circumcision was imposed in an attempt to prevent masturbation. God, here's that terrible vice of masturbation again. People really were excited about that. Now, Galler further describes the history of medicalized circumcision. No scientific studies were carried out to determine the efficacy and safety of circumcision prior to its introduction into medical practice, nor were any studies conducted to determine the social effects of imposing genital alteration surgery on a large portion of the population. Now, the South Koreans started to circumcise children during the American trusteeship after World War II, and the American cultural practice of circumcision became nearly universal in South Korea after the Korean War of 1950 to 52. In 1949, Gairdner wrote that circumcision was medically unnecessary and non-beneficial and contradicted because of complications and deaths. Now, let me pause here. Complications and deaths in newborns. I don't know of a single case of a newborn being circumcised on the eighth day that is taking off just the foreskin, not the whole covering of the glands itself, has ever produced a single death. I have not seen one single documented piece of evidence in that regard. And I've only seen a few babies who were circumcised prior to or after the eighth day that have bled to death. Now, there have been some, but very few. And it typically is the radical circumcision that takes off all of the skin clear back behind the glands itself. Now, the British National Health Service deleted non-therapeutic neonatal circumcision from the schedule of covered procedures in 1950. The incidence of neonatal circumcision in the United Kingdom declined sharply as a very low level after publication of this article of the procedure, or after the procedure was delisted by the National Health Service. Now, America waited another 20 years before addressing the problem of non-therapeutic serpent circumcision. The Journal of the American Medical Association published an influential landmark article by Dr. E. Noel Preston. Dr. Preston established that there is no therapeutic or prophylactic benefit to circumcision, and he also cited undesirable psychological, sexual, and medico-legal difficulties. Now, influenced by Preston, the American Academy of Pediatrics, that's called the AAP in 1971, issued a statement that there are no valid medical reasons, for instance, for circumcision in the neonatal period. This marked the beginning of the end of America's infatuation with male circumcision. The incidence of male neonatal circumcision in the United States peaked in 1971 and began a slow decline that continues to the present day. Well, those are facts and figures that we have already covered. I mean, we've been looking at these dates, 1971, no medical reasons, and then I came back and rebutted that. Now, remember, when an expert witness like a doctor testifies, as they have in these documents, of course, we're handicapped here. We haven't got any cross-examination, and we don't have the live testimony. But we're looking at what appears to be their statements, and we'll presume their statements to be true, accurate, and correct for the sake of our analysis. And by 1971, when they come back and they say that there's no medical justification for it, and then we come back and we read, oh yes, there's lots of scientific studies, lots of facts and figures, lots of knowledge and information, such as the vitamin K story. This is what we call the preponderance of evidence. You don't have to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt. What we need here, what would a reasonable person conclude after reviewing this evidence? Now, that's in your purview. It's not for me to sit here and say, well, you know, if you were a rational person, you'd come to this conclusion. See, that is what we call leading and suggestive. The objective here is to present you with these facts concerning circumcision so that you can draw a conclusion. Now, a judge will oftentimes let the jury know what his thinking is. I mean, he'll tell you, I think that guy's guilty as hell. Or, you know, thus and such, or so-and-so, and he'll give certain rules. And then, of course, when he says, I think that guy's guilty, if they release him, then you can't appeal it, and if they find him guilty, they overturn the judge's or the jury's verdict, and then they say, well, the jury was prejudiced by the judge, and then they turn around and reverse the conviction and order a new trial. But in this scenario here, the evidence that I'm compiling and presenting is both sides of the argument. You've got the legal side that says this is mayhem. You've got the religious side that says this is child abuse, and we ought to stop it in the name of Jesus. And then you've got the historical perspective. You've got the medical perspective. You've got the Jewish perspective. Now we're looking at the historical perspective. All of these perspectives weigh in on the subject of circumcision. Now, we haven't gotten to the contract yet. Remember I told you that in litigation, we want to see the contract, and we want to know what are the intentions of the lawmakers. The two lawmakers in this case are Abraham and God. And this contract is written up in Genesis chapter 17. We'll take a look at it when we come to it. I've got the information here. We'll take a look at the New Testament. What did Paul do? Did Paul and the apostles repeal circumcision? Is it true that the New Testament now repeals circumcision? Circumcision used to be a good practice, but it was found wanting, and so we've repealed it. We'll investigate that. We'll look at the legal basis for that argument. Now, the development of new information in the medical literature since 1975 caused the AAP to revisit the matter of circumcision in 1989, and a new task force under the chair of Edgar J. Schoen, M.D., examined new data about neonatal pain, behavior changes, and the loss of sexual sensitivity secondary to neonatal circumcision. New data also conclusively established the role of the human HPV in the pathogenesis of genital cancers. This removed any lingering belief that the foreskin somehow caused cancer. The Canadian Pediatric Society revisited the matter of neonatal circumcision in 1996. A new evidence-based policy statement was issued that strengthened its 1975 recommendation, stating that circumcision is medically unnecessary and the CPS recommended circumcision should not be routinely performed. And the incidence of neonatal circumcision in the United States has continued to decline and stood at only 60% in 1996. In that same year, the Australian College of Pediatrics, the ACP, reported that the incidence of neonatal circumcision in Australia has continued to decline to 10%. And the ACP termed circumcision traumatic, a possible violation of human rights, and called for parents to be provided with full and complete information about circumcision before making a decision. The circumcision information and resource pages were created in 1995 to provide a source of accurate information about circumcision on the World Wide Web. John R. Taylor and colleagues published a landmark article in 1996 that described original research into the anatomy and history of the foreskin. The research showed that the foreskin is highly innervated tissue with the characteristics of a sensory organ designed to provide erogenous sensation. Notice that it was designed to provide this, didn't just accidentally evolve. Now, the American Academy of Pediatrics and the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, in a joint statement, reclassified neonatal circumcision from routine to elective in 1997. Now, the change in this policy was announced in the year after the publication of Taylor's important article that describes in detail the injury inherent in every circumstance and every circumcision. This action removes any suggestion that circumcision is beneficial or that it is recommended by medical authorities, and it may also be an attempt to shift legal liability for the injury that is inherent in every child's circumcision from the doctor to the parents. All right, now we're picking up again where we started this discussion. Is there a legal liability for, let's say, hospitals, doctors? And does this follow the New World Order program and the United Nations? So the Council on Scientific Affairs of the American Medical Association issued a policy report in December of 99 that reclassified neonatal circumcision as a non-therapeutic procedure, and this may have a medical legal impact. So if you have disease, circumcision isn't going to cure it. But that's a little different than if you're circumcised, you may not get disease, leaving out epilepsy and 55 other diseases that probably don't have any connection. At least the AIDS researchers that we have investigated tend to show that there has been some benefit from circumcision, but we don't know why and we don't know how much. All right, next time we'll complete this segment of the program and we'll take a look at some more religious arguments against the circumcision procedure and the controversy over this necessity of circumcision. And then we'll take up the contract itself after we finish the next segment. We'll take a look at the contract with Abraham. We'll take a look at the New Testament. We'll take a look at circumcision from the perspective of the Bible. So far, I have left the Bible, which should be the final authority on this thing of law. And I'll show you why when we get to it. And I've left it for last so that we could take a look at what the argument is first, and then let's see if we can settle the argument by looking at the law and the lawmakers, the contract and the contracting parties. All right, you've been listening to The Law Hour. The Law Hour is brought to you by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. And The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. And remember that The Law Hour is an educational service that's brought to you in the public interest. I'm out of time. We'll see you back here next time on The Law Hour. Thanks for listening, and until next time, goodbye, friends.